Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Candy Lewis, along with my co-host, Kitty Bullet Lewis. And I'll say happy Thanksgiving and a week full of gratitude, whether you're listening to this before or after Thanksgiving. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And again, the theme for this month has been loving the unlikable. The energy of gratitude. Be content with what you have. Rejoice in the way things are. When you realize there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you. Lao Tzu. Gratitude is one of the chief graces of human existence and is crowned in heaven with a consciousness of unity. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 497. While Americans celebrate Thanksgiving, people in more than 13 other countries hold similar holidays honoring harvest and gratitude. Across time and culture, humanity shares an instinctive wisdom, pausing to acknowledge that what has been given sustains life far beyond the feast. The phrase, "what we appreciate, appreciates," points to a spiritual truth. Gratitude magnifies awareness of sufficiency. The very act of recognition is a bridge between forgetting and remembering our divine origin, a return to the source from which all good flows. The traditions of many philosophies remind us that gratitude need not wait for a holiday. Indigenous wisdom teaches that gratitude is a living relationship with nature, ancestors, and spirit, a reciprocal energy sustaining harmony and balance in all life. Stoic philosophy offers that gratitude frees us from clinging to outcomes, guiding us to embrace life as part of a larger, benevolent order. Sufi mysticism calls gratitude the highest prayer, dissolving illusions of separation and drawing us into union with the beloved. Science of Mind affirms that thanksgiving is a creative energy, aligning thought with the infinite. Gratitude is for what is eternally true, the divine source, ever-present and abundant. Today, as we gather or pause alone, we are reminded to make Thanksgiving a way of life, a daily practice of seeing the harvest already within and around us. The invitation is simple. Cultivate gratitude as an ongoing awareness, not a yearly ritual. Let it become breath and being, a seed that continually grows into joy, generosity, and connection. Affirmation. Each day I harvest the gifts of this life, giving thanks for what is and trusting the infinite for what is yet to unfold. Letting fear through. Fear does not prevent death, it prevents life. Buddhist proverb. There is something within you beyond all doubt and fear, something that has never been limited by your acts or destroyed by your feeling. This is the only something that can make you whole. Ernest Holmes, This Thing Called You, page 4. Author Mark Nepo shares a powerful story from his 30s when he was gripped by fear after a rare lymphoma diagnosis. One night, he dreamed that the Tang Dynasty poet Tu Fu appeared, sitting cross-legged on a sandy shore, scratching delicate patterns with a branch. In the dream, Mark crouched beside him and urgently asked, "How do I block the fear?" The poet remained silent, continuing to trace lines in the sand. Nepo grew frustrated, repeating his question with desperation. Finally, Tu Fu looked up and simply asked, "How does a tree block the wind?" Then he vanished. When Nepo woke, he understood. A tree doesn't block the wind, it lets it pass through. Nepo's telling of the dream reminds me that fear cannot be walled off, outrun, or medicated away. So much of life is built around prevention energy, crafting routines and defenses to avoid discomfort that we miss the moments of spontaneity and freedom. Letting fear through is about meeting it directly, refusing to push it away or cling to safety. It's turning toward the fear with courage and curiosity, even when it whispers the old familiar refrains, "You are not enough, you are unworthy, you are unlovable." To let fear through is to keep showing up anyway, to love instead of seeking love, to listen deeply instead of waiting for validation, to move toward life instead of shrinking from it. Each time we allow fear to pass through us, we reclaim more of our wholeness. Affirmation. I allow fear to pass through me, standing rooted in love and presence. We turn now to the Daily Word, published by Unity. Gratitude. I am grateful for all my blessings. Gratitude is the song my heart sings. Practicing gratitude keeps my awareness on the many blessings in my life and opens me to receive even more. I feel grateful for all of it, from the smallest things like my morning coffee, the sunlight on my face, or a friendly smile, to the most important, including love of family and friends, peace in my heart, and joy in my life. Gratitude is one of the great gifts of spiritual living, a way to keep the goodness of God, Spirit, the universe, at the forefront of my mind. No matter the number of good things in my life, I give thanks to God as the source of them all. I'm grateful to live, grateful to love, grateful to be a beloved child of Spirit. World peace. World peace begins with me. When I think of world peace, it feels like a huge undertaking. How can I help bring about world peace? The answer is in my thoughts, beliefs, and actions. I focus on the divine presence within me. Every time I think and act for my spiritual nature, I am contributing peace to the world. I may not be able to control what is happening in my immediate surroundings or at the farthest reaches of the earth. However, I can control how I think and act as I go through life. I spend time each day being at peace with what is and what will be. Affirming that blessings are present everywhere calms me. If I start to worry, I recenter myself in spirit. I feel blessed as the seed of peace blooms in my heart and blesses the world. And from Mark Nepos, the Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Kinship of Gratitude. When you make the two one, when you make the inner as outer and the outer as inner, then shall you enter the kingdom. Jesus. The goal of all experience is to remove whatever might keep us from being whole. The things we learn through love and pain reduce our walls and bring our inner and outer life together, and all the while the friction of being alive erodes whatever impediments remain. But the simplest and deepest way to make who we are at one with the world is through the kinship of gratitude. Nothing brings the worlds of spirit and earth together more quickly. To be grateful means giving thanks for more than just the things we want, but also for the things that surmount our pride and stubbornness. Sometimes the things I've wanted and worked for, if I actually received them, would have crushed me. Sometimes just giving thanks for the mystery of it all brings everything and everyone closer, the way suction pulls streams of water together. So take a chance and openly give thanks, even if you're not sure what for, and feel the plenitude of all that is living rush up against your heart. Sit quietly and meditate on what keeps you from knowing yourself. Breathe deeply and lower your walls with an offering of gratitude that is not attached to any one thing. Now inhale with gratitude and exhale what remains in the way. Repeat this several times throughout your day. We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Cynthia Ramirez Lindenmeyer's monthly column, Spiritual Not Religious, Spiritual Life Insurance. Insurance companies spend billions shaping our subconscious. You probably can readily fill in the blank. You're in good hands with blank. Like a good neighbor, blank is there. Your mind, for better or worse, knows which insurance companies are represented by a gecko and an emu. You even know the jingles for insurance companies. Our minds don't merely process advertisements, they metabolize them and turn suggestion into belief. Raymond Charles Barker, a close colleague of Ernest Holmes, once wrote, 90% of the way you handle life comes from the subconscious mind. The conscious mind makes choices, but the subconscious accepts and carries them out without judgment. It does not filter or say, this thought is true, that one is false. It simply absorbs whatever is given to it. Holmes described the conscious mind as the seed planter and the subconscious as the soil. What we sow in thought manifests in expression. I love listening to audiobooks when I walk my dogs, and while listening to Barker's The Science of Successful Living, I heard these words, scientific prayer is spiritual life insurance. I literally stopped in my tracks. What a profound statement. He used the phrase only once, but it struck me. We spend trillions insuring our homes, cars, health, and even pets. But do we insure our spirit? Life constantly hurls ads at our minds, fear, judgment, worry, and division. Unless we consciously plant divine ideas, our subconscious will run with whatever the world gives it. This is why spiritual mind treatment matters. It protects us from false beliefs and self-sabotage by aligning us with the one life. When we tame our thoughts, affirm truth, and practice treatment, we hold an active spiritual policy. And unlike earthly insurance, the supply of divine ideas is infinite. The premiums are free, and the coverage never expires. The universal mind, the infinite source, always has the resources to pay the claim. And from the same issue, an article by Ernest Holmes, The Healing Power of Love. Friends, love is still the greatest thing in the world. Love is the greatest healing power on earth. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love, John 4:8. And since we all love something or someone, we all must know God, Spirit, the universe. It is this knowledge of God that we possess that we wish to increase until it fills our lives with the holy light of heaven. The more we love, the better we feel. And I don't mean just mentally and emotionally, for love has an actual healing effect on the physical body and brings to the mind a deep confidence, a calm trust, and a sense of security. Children who are reared in love grow into a sense of security that never can come from a home atmosphere of bickering, suspicion, and disagreement. Love and a broad-gauge tolerance for living are the two greatest things in life, and there can be no deep understanding of the meaning of life without them. But how often we hesitate to express our admiration for each other. In some peculiar and silly way, we are reluctant to show affection. Is it because we fear people will think us too sentimental, too soft, as though we were not equipped to meet the hard facts of life? I've never yet met a person, no matter how loudly they protest, who, if you scratch the surface, will not reveal a human tenderness. And I have noticed, as I know you must have, that the more aggressive the person is, the more completely they're trying to cover up, hide, conceal, and bury within themselves one of the greatest desires of the human mind, to love and be loved in return. It is no wonder that the great and the good and the wise throughout all the ages have told us that God, Spirit, the universe, is love, and that faith exercised through love can accomplish the miracle of life, the fulfillment of all desire, the rounding out of the personality into creative warmth and color and accomplishment. We are born with an irresistible desire to love and to be loved. At the very center of our being, there is a creative impulsion that ever seeks fulfillment, but can find no fulfillment until its energy is expended on people and in events. The basis of this whole impulsion is love and the givingness of the self. This is why it is written that God so loved the world that it gave. Love always desires to give and also wishes that the gift will be received, that it may come back to the giver multiplied. Love must flow outward. Love is more than an idle sentiment. It is the very foundation on which our whole psychic and spiritual nature is built. It is the great impulsion of every human life. Without love, we are mentally and emotionally incomplete. Since the relationship between the mind and body is so intimate, even the physical body cannot receive its highest stimulant without love. Whenever there is a deep sense of being rejected or unwanted, unneeded, and unloved, there comes with it an outer aggressive attitude, a sort of combativeness. When love does not flow out, aggression seems to take its place, and when confidence is not gained, it is often turned into suspicion. Adults who always wonder what others think of them or who feel unaccepted by society, people who become what we call antisocial, may have lacked proper affection in childhood. The joy of living. The life without love is unfulfilled, always seeming to carry the burden of rejection, leaving a person moody and morose, as well as unhappy and discontented. Well, there is very little use in diagnosing a condition unless we find a way to heal it. The diagnosis must always be followed by some method or procedure that will remove the cause of the wrong condition. This is why the diagnosis is considered so important in medicine and in the right emotional adjustments to life. But diagnosis must be followed by right action. If we have a broken limb, the surgeon puts the splintered parts together again so that the natural spontaneous currents of life may restore it. And so it is with all broken lives, all warped minds, and all frustrated ambitions, for most of us are only half alive. And if we could blanket the whole world with one universal diagnosis, we should discover that an unbelievable amount of the troubles from which the human mind and body suffer can be brought right back to a few fundamental propositions. Both dominant and prominent among them would be this idea of love, which is as fundamental as life itself. Without love, life is dead. Without love, some part of body and mind lies dormant, unexpressed, and crippled. And God so loved the world that it gave life, joy, happiness, peace, and confidence, and trust and faith, all summed up in this one thought, the joy of living. It is this divine givingness and this joy in living that we must return to, for without it we shall remain incomplete. Love remains empty until it gives. Since every day is a fresh beginning and every hour a new event, we can begin to resurrect ourselves here and now. We can make up our minds that we are not afraid of the idea of love. We are not afraid that it will be misunderstood or misinterpreted. We can make up our minds that we are going to live from this spontaneous center within us, this flowing out from the self into everyone we meet and into every situation we encounter. If God so loved that it gave, we must both love and give. Love always liberates. It always increases our livingness. But love remains empty until it gives of itself. It is not, then, love of the self that we need, but the givingness of love from the self that opens up the healing channels of life, not only in our minds and emotions, but in our physical bodies and our objective affairs. God so loved the world that it gave. Jesus said, "Give, and it shall be given unto you." Love is unfulfilled until it gives of itself. It cannot be returned until it is lavishly expended. Again, the miracle of life takes place, for the more love we have and the more we give, the more of God, of Spirit, of the universe, we express. It is from the prison of isolation that we all escape. We alone possess the key that sets the captive free. Love costs us nothing to give out, and back of all the fear and doubt and uncertainty in daily living, back of the hurt and the sensitiveness and the bleeding heart, there is a great urge, a great craving, a great desire, a great love seeking to liberate us. And here's a meditation from him. Since this is Thanksgiving month, I have chosen as the thought for our meditation today, thanks be to God for the unspeakable gift. This gift is the gift of life and everything that goes with it, love, friendship, joy, peace, happiness, and abundance. We lift up our hearts in grateful praise and thanksgiving to the giver of all life and feel thanksgiving to God, to Spirit, to the universe, for the unspeakable gifts as we quietly repeat, today, I acknowledge and bless the Divine Spirit as a living presence in everyone I meet. Today, I acknowledge the divine law of good governing everything I do, and I bless this good. I acknowledge the God's abundance, the outpouring of the Spirit, the manifestation of the one divine life everywhere. I sincerely desire that every thought in my mind and every impulse in my whole being shall be constructive and life-giving, shall radiate that light that lighteth every path. I bless the small things in my life that they may increase. I bless the good I now possess that it may be multiplied. I bless my family. I bless my friends. I bless my country. And I bless the whole world. My thought goes out to everything that lives in the acknowledgement of the divine presence everywhere, in everything, and in everyone. This article is excerpted from The Healing Power of Love by Ernest Holmes, as heard on This Thing Called Life, November 19th, 1950. And from the same issue, we turn to Mark Waldman and Andrew Newberg's monthly column, Science and Spirituality. Where does your personality come from? Have you ever taken a moment to wonder about your personality? What it is? Where does it come from? Is it your own creation or the result of being shaped by others? The first hurdle is the definition. Dictionaries, educators, psychologists, biologists, and neuroscientists all describe personality differently. Is it character, nature, disposition, temperament, behavior, a trait of your identity? Is it genetically shaped? Is it environmentally influenced? Is it an emotion? Is it a thought? Or is it merely a philosophical fantasy that doesn't really exist? Based on the research, I would say it is all of the above, and psychology textbooks will state that we are all multiple personalities. When we are angry, a specific personality emerges, coupled with specific thoughts and specific behaviors. But when we are happy, sad, excited, tired, or depressed, other personalities emerge, coupled with different thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. If you ruminate on one emotion or a specific goal or fantasy, that may shape your predominant personality. So in essence, everyone has a unique persona that is partly shaped by genetics, by the experiences you have, and by the choices you consciously make to change your behavior or alter your moods. This is why all personality tests are flawed, and why when you take one a second time, you'll often get different results. So let me ask you two intriguing questions. What personality do you want to have, and what personality do you think you have? Warning, whatever mood you're in will change the way you respond. Don't believe me? Try this experiment. First, write down as fast as you can right now what you think your personality is. Now close your eyes and deeply relax. When you feel pleasantly calm, ask your intuition what your personality is and write that down. Now think about something that makes you really angry and watch what kind of personality emerges. Finally, ask yourself this question: are any of these personalities really you? The good news, you can choose to change your personality by changing your behaviors, by changing the way you think, feel, and react to different situations, or by changing your work or relationships. But remember this, each part of your brain and each emotion you have contains a unique personality that will be released whenever the circumstances demand. And guess what? Everyone also has a spiritual personality shaped by the beliefs you hold and the meditation practices you do. Those who deeply believe in hell might exhibit a more serious and moral personality. Choose to focus on the pure consciousness of the universe, as some Eastern religions profess, and you'll feel a sense of expansiveness that makes you feel connected to everything. But if you practice Zen, the teacher will whack you every time you think you've reached an enlightened state. The result? Your personality dissolves, and you'll experience a sense of beingness. Practice Kundalini Yoga and your personality will shift between different chakras of energy. Embrace the love of Jesus, as many Christian contemplatives do, and your personality may become softer, filled with empathy and compassion for others. And if you embrace the Jewish concept of L'chaim, which is a toast to life, your personality can easily be filled with joy. Imagine what your personality would be if you embraced all of the positive beliefs of the world's spiritual traditions. Our research shows that those who do so become more tolerant and inclusive of others. Can you imagine a world filled with such personalities? Consider this. If you make a practice of surrendering all of your beliefs for just a few minutes every day, in those brief moments of serenity, your personality will fade along with all of your worries, fears, and doubts. That's what our brain scan studies show, and that's what we call a neurological state of enlightenment. We turn now to the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Alan Hamilton, MD. Yes, we are born geniuses. Now imagine what could happen if we took our creativity seriously. To begin to think about born geniuses, we need to look back to the late 1960s when NASA was looking forward to the future of space exploration and decided to find out how to identify and cultivate the next generation of leaders and project heads, people who would be capable of solving unforeseen obstacles the agency would face in the decades ahead. So they went looking for the seminal, creative, divergent thinkers in their midst. Divergent thinking is an expansive process at the heart of brainstorming, where an individual can entertain a host of possibilities, one of which may be workable, or several different avenues of pursuit. It calls for the brain to use a loose filter where ideas, concepts, and perceptions percolate through different functional parts of the brain and interact in subconscious and symbolic relationships. Divergent thinking is where great leaps in insight typically begin. Convergent thinking, by contrast, is intent on getting to the one best solution quickly by ruthlessly canceling out extraneous noise and data streams that do not directly contribute to the solution at hand. Think of convergent thinking as the chef who toils away to faithfully reproduce the perfect five-star dish, while the divergent chef is off marrying traditional Thai cuisine with handmade Ligurian pasta and guacamole just for the fun of it. These are radically different kinds of thinking. Progress requires both, but you can't do both at once, nor can you train both ways of thinking at once or in the same ways. The two paths lead in opposite directions. The genius test. The space agency chose George Land, PhD, to head a team to develop and validate a unique psychological inventory to identify NASA's divergent geniuses. And then something truly divergent unfolded. Land used the new test to evaluate about 1,600 4- and 5-year-old kids who were preparing to enter preschool or kindergarten, and it turned out that 98% of the children scored at or above the genius level. In other words, the data confirmed what so many proud parents believe. My child is a creative genius. Land kept testing children as they progressed through elementary school and into high school, and the news became less optimistic. By the 5th grade, less than 30% still qualified as creative geniuses. By the 10th grade, the number had dropped to 10%. When he tested 25-year-olds, only 2% still met the criteria for creative geniuses. As Land concluded, we are literally educating people out of their creative capacities. Think of it. When kids are born, almost any one of them can reasonably dream of stepping up to the microphone as an astronaut, a rock star, or an Oscar or Nobel Prize winner giving their acceptance speech. 20 years later, the grown kid is more likely to stand at a microphone dutifully asking, "Would you like fries with that?" A child as a stem cell. The gradual extinction of creative and imaginative genius within children is obviously worrisome. Given the blazing pace of change in the 21st century, we should educate kids to be increasingly flexible, adaptive, and creative. But that's not what's happening. With our over-reliance on standardized test results and the strong push for curricula containing science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, STEM courses, we're turning our little angels into drones. What we need are educational systems designed to give children better wings, and the way to do it is pretty simple. But first, ask yourself some simple questions. Am I an artist? Am I a singer? Am I a poet? Am I a dancer, a musician, or an actor? If you answer no to any of these questions, ask yourself, why not? Over the decades since Land's landmark studies, clear evidence proves that every human baby is inherently creative. Essentially, a stem cell that can become any and every type of artist. As newborns, we respond to musical intervals. At 3 months, we can keep time with musical rhythms with adult-like precision. And we begin to move and imitate gestures associated with music, preparing the way for dancing. Before we can speak, we can recognize different musical rhythms and pitches, and we show a preference for notes that blend harmoniously over dissonant combinations. By this time, we can also draw spontaneously, and we readily engage in role-playing and make-believe. These early behaviors are not taught. Our mirror neurons, for example, help us mime gestures, form empathy, and begin creating the foundational building blocks of dance and drama. Our limbic systems, motor cortex, and brain's auditory regions light up with increased activity during artistic experiences. In other words, each of us is endowed with substantive artistic gifts which arise from the brain's fundamental architecture. So creativity is not a luxury. It is in our DNA, built into the structure of our very brain cells. We are born to be artists. As Sir Ken Robinson, one of the great advocates for artistic education, said, we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it. Or rather, we get educated out of it. Got art? Given that these artistic gifts are innate, one can ask, what happens when those gifts are nurtured? In a word, magic. Arts education has been proven to enhance a child's creativity and to improve cognitive, emotional, and social development. Students involved in music, dance, drama, and visual arts programming will score higher on standardized tests, exhibit better memory, and show stronger executive and decision-making functions. These children have an increased capacity to solve problems more creatively and adaptively. On the level of socialization and interpersonal skills acquisition, Participating in the performing arts teaches children to collaborate, receive, and apply feedback, as well as to accelerate their emotional intelligence development. Children in these programs demonstrate a more developed sense of identity, increased confidence in group work and public presentations, and a greater willingness to express themselves. The benefits also carry over into adulthood. Students exposed to the arts are more likely to vote, volunteer, and participate in the civic life of their community. Arts education is especially potent in underserved communities, providing an opportunity for personal expression and a pathway for collaborative endeavors. As a general rule of thumb, the more impoverished and under-resourced a child's life is, the more vital it becomes to provide ample opportunity for that child to learn and practice the performing arts. Boosting creativity is the best thing one can do for a child who is going to have to fake it until they make it. When the arts go missing. Despite overwhelming evidence of such benefits, nearly half of the schools in the United States have no drama or theater arts programs. More than 1.3 million elementary students in America attend a school that offers no arts education at all. Predictably, students at low-income schools are five times more likely to lack access to art-related curriculum, and arts teachers are often among the first to be laid off amid budget shortfalls. Imaginative play is typically replaced by test prep and digital consumption, with devastating results. Teens and young adults in such schools exhibit increased rates of depression, anxiety, and disconnection. The students are less resilient, less empathetic, and less equipped to solve complex problems. We need to remember that we evolved in small communities filled with dance, singing, art, and storytelling. What happens to children and communities when we take that away should not be a surprise to anybody. Recreating magic. Every child is an artist, says Pablo Picasso, one of the 20th century's greatest artistic geniuses. The problem is how to remain an artist once we grow up. Picasso completed his first official portrait at age 15 and his last at 91, with leaps in creativity all along the way. Ironically, such leaps late in life were considered practically impossible during Picasso's lifetime because the brain was believed to have only so many neurons that gradually got used up. It wasn't until the 1990s, with the discovery of neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change and reorganize itself throughout life, that we learned that creative artistry doesn't have to end with adulthood. It's never too late to reclaim one's creative spark. Given neuroplasticity, one can ask, what happens when creativity is rekindled later in life? In two words, more magic. We now know that artistic pursuits stimulate memory, improve mood, reduce stress, and even lower the risk of dementia. The arts offer healing for veterans, trauma survivors, and those in palliative care. In community settings, the arts build empathy and social bonds. Theater improves the ability to see and understand different perspectives. Music activates pleasure pathways. Storytelling reconnects us to meaning. Studies show that more than half of American adults now engage in some form of artistic expression each year, including playing instruments, painting, crafting, dancing, and writing. And that's grand. But the same data also suggests that at least tens of millions, and perhaps more than 100 million, adult Americans don't do anything artistic at all. And we wonder why our country seems so divided and unhappy. Artistic expression should be seen not just as a personal journey, but as a civic necessity. Art is not a matter of ornamentation, but a crucible of identity, imagination, and survival. To revive our humanity, we must make space for the artist in every child and adult. Well before brain science proved the point, President John F. Kennedy said, "The life of the arts, far from being an interruption, a distraction in the life of a nation, is very close to the center of a nation's purpose and is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization." We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications. And you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio on demand. We return now to the Book of Joy, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. And we had started a section on loneliness, no need for introduction. We often are alone without feeling lonely, and feel lonely when we are not alone, as when we are in a crowd of strangers or at a party of people we do not know. Clearly, the psychological experience of loneliness is quite different from the physical experience of being alone. We can feel joy when we are alone, but not when we are lonely. After our tea break, the dialogue returned to this topic. Your Holiness, we finished our last session talking about loneliness, and I wanted to come back to the subject for one more question. Monks spend a lot of time alone, so what is the difference between being alone and being lonely? The Dalai Lama turned to the Archbishop to see if he wanted to answer. No, I've not been a monk, man. You start. Monks separate themselves from the material world, not just physically, but mentally. According to his religion, he said, pointing to the Archbishop, Christian monks are always thinking they're in the light of God, dedicated to serving God. We cannot touch God directly, so the only way is serving God's children, humanity, so we are never really lonely. Much depends on your attitude. If you are filled with negative judgment and anger, then you will feel separate from other people. You will feel lonely. But if you have an open heart and are filled with trust and friendship, even if you are physically alone, even living a hermit's life, you will never feel lonely. It is ironic, isn't it, I offered, remembering Lama Tenzin, who told us while we bought donuts on our way to Dharamsala that he had a desire to live in a cave for the traditional length of over 3 years. You can spend 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days in a cave and not be lonely, but you can be lonely in the middle of a crowd. That's right, the Dalai Lama replied. There are at least 7 billion people, and the number of sentient beings is limitless. If you are always thinking about the 7 billion human beings, you will never experience loneliness. The only thing that will bring happiness is affection and warm-heartedness. This really brings inner strength and self-confidence, reduces fear, develops trust, and trust brings friendship. We are social animals, and cooperation is necessary for our survival, but cooperation is entirely based on trust. When there is trust, people are brought together. Whole nations are brought together. When you have a more compassionate mind and cultivate warm-heartedness, the whole atmosphere around you becomes more positive and friendlier. You see friends everywhere. If you feel fear and distrust, then other people will distance themselves. They will also feel cautious, suspicious, and distrustful. Then comes the feeling of loneliness. When someone is warm-hearted, they're always completely relaxed. If you live with fear and consider yourself as something special, then automatically, emotionally, you are distanced from others. You then create the basis for feelings of alienation from others and loneliness. So I never consider, even when giving a talk to a large crowd, that I am something special. I am His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, he said, mocking his venerated status. I always emphasize that when I meet people, we are all the same human beings. 1,000 people, same human being. 10,000 or 100,000, same human being, mentally, emotionally, and physically. Then you see no barrier. Then my mind remains completely calm and relaxed. If too much emphasis on myself and I start to think I'm something special, then more anxiety, more nervousness. The paradox is that although the drive behind excessive self-focus is to seek greater happiness for yourself, it ends up doing exactly the opposite. When you focus too much on yourself, you become disconnected and alienated from others. In the end, you also become alienated from yourself, since the need for connection with others is such a fundamental part of who we are as human beings. This excessive self-focus is also bad for your health. Too much fear and distrust, too much focus on yourself leads to stress and high blood pressure. Many years ago, I was at a gathering of medical scientists and researchers at Columbia University in New York. One of the medical scientists said in his presentation that those people who disproportionately use the first-person pronouns, I, me, 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 and mine, have a significantly greater risk of having a heart attack. He didn't explain why, but I felt this must be true. This is a deep insight. With too much self-focus, your vision becomes narrow, and with this, even a small problem appears out of proportion and unbearable. Also, fear and distrust come from too much focus on yourself. This will cause you to always remain separate from your human brothers and sisters. This brings loneliness and difficulty communicating with other people. After all, you are part of the community, so you have to deal with them. Your interests and your future depend on other people. If you isolate yourself from them, how can you be a happy person? You just have more worry and more stress. Sometimes I say that too much self-centeredness closes our inner door and it becomes hard to communicate with other people. When we are concerned with the well-being of other human beings, that inner door opens and we are able to communicate very easily with other people. The Dalai Lama was saying that when one is thinking about others with kindness and compassion, one is never lonely. Open-heartedness, warm-heartedness, is the antidote to loneliness. It has often amazed me that one day I can walk down the street feeling judgmental and critical of others, and I will feel separate and lonely. And the next day, I can walk down the same street with more open-hearted acceptance and compassion, and suddenly everyone seems warm and friendly. It is almost as if my inner state of mind and heart changes the physical and social world around me completely. The focus on the importance of warm-heartedness echoes the research of social psychologists Shenbo Zhang and Shira Gabriel, who have found that when people are feeling lonely or socially rejected, they literally seek warmth, like sipping hot soup. What the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were saying is that we can generate that warmth simply by opening our hearts and turning our attention and our concern to other people. Archbishop, did you want to add anything? I know you haven't been a monastic, but you do spend a lot of time in prayer and meditation on your own. Certainly in our sort of prayer, the Archbishop explained, it is never the alone speaking to the alone. Our concept of God is of a God who is one, but who is a fellowship, a community, the Trinity, and we are made in the image of this God. When you become a Christian, you are incorporated into a fellowship. So even when you go into retreat, you are not alone. It's similar to what the Dalai Lama is saying, I said. If you connect, even if that fellowship is 7 billion people, then you don't feel lonely. Yes, yes, the Archbishop replied. It's something of an oxymoron to be lonely. But I can very well understand when you feel alienated, when you are not on the same wavelength, as it were, and one wants to enter into that sense of being in solidarity. I don't think we help people by making them feel guilty. We want to try to be as welcoming as we possibly can and say that the experience they have is something that many other people also have. Feeling lonely is not something that we do deliberately. I don't think you set out to say, I want to feel lonely. It's just there. It happens. And for very many reasons. You want to make the person feel really as they are, special, and accepted as they are, and help to open them. I can very well understand the incredible anguish and pain that someone must feel who is cooped up in a room because they are scared of going out and being rejected. And you just hope and pray that they will find a fellowship of people who will embrace and welcome them. It's wonderful to see people who were closed down open up like a beautiful flower in the warmth and acceptance of those around them. What I had learned from our dialogue was that we did not have to wait for others to open their hearts to us. By opening our heart to them, we could feel connected to them, whether on a mountaintop or in the middle of Manhattan. Envy. That guy goes past yet again in his Mercedes-Benz. It is not that you wake up in the morning and you say, now I'm going to be envious. It just rises spontaneously, the Archbishop began, once again arguing for the naturalness of our emotions and for self-compassion. I mean, you get up and you're trying to be a good person, and that guy goes past yet again for the third time this week in his Mercedes-Benz or some other very nice car. You've been trying not to feel jealous each time he passes with his car, but this feeling just comes up. Comparison is indeed human. Even beyond human, it is natural throughout the animal world. As the Dalai Lama would point out, even dogs that are eating together peacefully can suddenly start comparing the size of their portion to another's, and a fight can break out with barking and the gnashing of teeth. But it is for humans that envy can become a source of great dissatisfaction. There is a Tibetan Buddhist teaching that says what causes suffering in life is a general pattern of how we relate to others. Envy toward the above, competitiveness toward the equal, and contempt toward the lower. Fairness seems to be hardwired into our genes, and so we're very uncomfortable with inequality of any sort. Primatologist Franz de Waal has a video of an experiment with Capuchin monkeys, our distant relatives who are often used in psychological tests as proxies for humans. In the video, which has gone wildly viral, one of the small-headed, long-limbed gray monkeys gives the experimenter a rock and then receives a cucumber slice as payment. The monkey is quite happy to do this over and over until he sees his neighbor perform the same rock-giving task but receive a grape. In the world of Capuchin monkeys, a grape is a better, sweeter food than a cucumber, perhaps for humans too. After the first monkey sees his neighbor getting a grape, he performs the rock-giving task yet again, although even more eagerly this time, his head now perking up in expectation at his grape reward. However, as required in this experiment of social comparisons, the experimenter gives the first monkey another cucumber instead of a grape. The Capuchin looks at the cucumber in his hand, pulling his head back in seeming disbelief, and then throws the cucumber back at the experimenter. In uncontrollable rage, the monkey grabs the bars of the cage and shakes them. This video became popular during the time of the Wall Street protests in the United States because it so succinctly and poignantly revealed how our fundamental instincts for fairness work and why inequality is stressful and damaging to a society. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama spoke frequently through the week of dialogues about the need to address inequality on the societal level. Yet however much we address these large global imbalances, as the Archbishop has pointed out, there will always be people who have more than we do, or who are more successful, or who are more talented, or smarter, or better looking. Usually we don't actually compare ourselves to the hedge fund billionaire, or to the genius scientist, or to the supermodel. We tend to compare ourselves to those who are in our social circle. As the old saying goes, if you want to be poor, find some rich friends. If you want to be rich, find some poor friends. Keeping up with the Joneses happens within a peer group. Jinpa told me that in the 1990s, the United States gave green cards to about 1,000 Tibetans in India as part of a special program for refugees. When these Tibetans started sending dollars back to their families, their neighbors started to get jealous because suddenly these families had more disposable income and could renovate their homes or buy their children motorbikes. It's not that those families who had no one in the United States had become poorer. It's that their neighbors with family in the States had suddenly become richer. According to the happiness research, upward comparisons are particularly corrosive to our well-being. Envy doesn't leave room for joy. The Tibetan word for envy is trekdok, which means heavy or constricted shoulders. And indeed, the feeling of envy leaves one with a pinched feeling of discontent and resentment, tinged with guilt. Buddhism sees envy as so corrosive that it compares it to a venomous snake that poisons us. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, one of the Ten Commandments forbids coveting thy neighbor's house. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were in disagreement about how to respond to envy, with the Archbishop coming down on the side of acceptance and self-forgiveness. I mean, you don't really have a great deal of control over it. I think far too frequently we are too hard on ourselves. We forget that many of these things affect all of us universally. I would hope that we could help people dissipate the guilt that they also tend to have, because almost everybody, when they are feeling envious, also has guilt attached to it. I would say the thing that we want to be saying to God's children out there is, for goodness sake, there are things about us that we do not control. The Archbishop then went on to offer a powerful remedy for envy, gratitude. I think that one of the best ways you can begin to counter it is that old one of counting your blessings. That might sound very old, grandfather style, but yes, it does help. You know, you might not have as big a house as that person, but you know what? You're not living in a shack. So being thankful for the things that you do in fact have can help. And then he offered another remedy, motivation. Certainly with envy, it can also be a spur, you know. It can help you say, I haven't got a car or a house like that guy, so why don't I aim to work to try and get something like that? As the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama had said, these external goals will not bring us true joy or lasting happiness, but motivation to improve our situation is certainly better than envy of someone else's. And then the Archbishop offered his final and most effective remedy, reframing. The very best is being able to ask yourself, why do I want to have a house that has 7 rooms when there are only 2 or 3 of us? Why do I want to have it? And you can turn it on its head and look at how we are in such a mess with climate change because of our galloping consumption, which for the environment has been nothing less than disastrous. So you buy the small electric car instead and you say, no, I don't need or want that big luxury car. So instead of it being your enemy, now it's your ally. Jinpa translated what the Archbishop has said for the Dalai Lama. That's exactly what I said, the Archbishop said and laughed. Fortunately, "You do not understand Tibetan," the Dalai Lama shot back with a quick smile. And then I saw him do what each of them did throughout the dialogues when they would come to a point of disagreement: reaffirm the relationship and compliment the other. It made me think of relationship scientists John Gottman and Julie Schwartz Gottman's observation that in successful conflict, there is a softened startup or a delicate entry into the area of disagreement. So I think, from my viewpoint, my spiritual brother's explanation is wonderful, wonderful. You see, at the moment that envy or jealousy develops, you no longer can maintain your peace of mind. So jealousy actually destroys your peace of mind. Then that jealousy can become corrosive to the relationship, even with your good friend. If you develop some sort of jealousy, it will be very harmful to your friendship. Even with husband and wife, if some kind of jealousy develops, it will be very harmful to the marriage. We can see it even with dogs that are eating in a happy atmosphere peacefully, but if one becomes jealous of what another has, conflict, fighting. It is important to cultivate any emotion that brings joyfulness and peace of mind. Any sort of emotion that disturbs this happiness and peace of mind, we must learn to avoid right from the beginning. I think it is a mistake just to consider all of these negative emotions, like anger or jealousy, as normal parts of our mind, something we cannot do much about. Too many negative emotions destroy our own peace of mind, our health, and create trouble in our family, with our friends, and even in our community. Often, envy comes because we are too focused on material possessions and not on our true inner values. When we focus on experience or knowledge, there is much less envy. But most important is to develop a sense of concern for others' well-being. If you have genuine kindness or compassion, then when someone gets something or has more success, you are able to rejoice in their good fortune. For a person who is committed to compassion practice and a genuine sense of concern for others' well-being, then you will rejoice in others' good fortune because you will be happy that what that person aspires for is being obtained. The Dalai Lama was describing the Buddhist concept of mudita, which is often translated as sympathetic joy and described as the antidote to envy. Mudita is so important in Buddhism that it is considered one of the four immeasurable qualities we can cultivate infinitely. The other three are loving kindness, compassion, and equanimity. Jinpa had explained how mudita works. If someone has something that we want, say a bigger house, we can consciously take joy in their good fortune by telling ourselves, "Good for him. Just like me, he too wants to be happy. He too wants to be successful. He too wants to support his family. May he be happy. I congratulate him and want him to have more success." Mudita recognizes that life is not a zero-sum game, that there's not just one slice of cake in which someone else is taking more means we get less. Mudita sees joy as limitless. As mentioned earlier, mudita is also the opposite feeling to Schadenfreude, the German word for the feeling of satisfaction or pleasure in hearing of others' misfortune. Schadenfreude sees us in a constant struggle of one against all others, and if someone else succeeds or accomplishes something, then we are somehow diminished, less successful, less acceptable, less lovable. Schadenfreude is a natural outgrowth of envy. Mudita is a natural outgrowth of compassion. Mudita is based on the recognition of our interdependence, or Ubuntu. The Archbishop explains that in African villages, one would ask in greeting, "How are we?" This understanding sees that someone else's achievements or happiness is in a very real way our own. The Archbishop frequently marvels at the extraordinary beauty and talent that we humans have. "Look how beautiful you all are," he will say to a gathered crowd. Unfortunately, however, most of us want to cut others down to our self-perceived size, and we see ourselves as so terribly small and weak. When we remember our interdependence, we discover we are so incredibly large and strong. There's an old story from the time of the Buddha, the Dalai Lama said. One day a king invited the Buddha and his monks for lunch. On his way to the palace, the Buddha passed by a beggar who was praising the king and smiling as he spoke of the beauty of the palace. After the king's servants served a long meal with many courses to the Buddha and his gathering of monks, the time came for making the dedication. The Buddha chanted a prayer to dedicate the merit or the good karma of the meal. However, instead of dedicating the merit of the host, the king, who made the generous offering of the meal to the Buddha and his assembly, which was the custom, the Buddha chose the beggar standing outside. Shocked, one of his senior monks asked the Buddha why he chose the beggar for his dedication prayer. The Buddha replied that the king was filled with pride in showing off his kingdom, while the beggar who had nothing was able to rejoice in the king's good fortune. For this reason, the beggar had created more merit than the king. Even today in Thailand, they maintain this tradition of dedicating the merit of the offering of a meal. During my visit to Thailand in the early 1970s, I had the honor to participate in one such lunch where one of the senior monks said prayers and offered the dedication. So rejoicing in others' good fortune really brings a lot of positive benefits. How, I asked the Dalai Lama, do people cultivate mudita? Firstly, we should recognize our shared humanity. These are our human brothers and sisters who have the same right and the same desire to have a happy life. This is not a spiritual thing. It is simply common sense. We are part of the same society. We are part of the same humanity. When humanity is happy, we will be happy. When humanity is peaceful, our own lives are peaceful. Just like if your family is happy, you are better off. If we have a strong sense of I and they, it is hard to practice mudita. We must develop the sense of we. Once you're able to develop that sense of common humanity and the oneness of humanity, then naturally you will want all others to be free from suffering and enjoy happiness. The desire for happiness is a natural instinct shared by everyone. It is simply a sense of concern, once again, for others' well-being. Obviously, envy is not a virtue, the Archbishop said, cautious once again that our self-development might lead to self-reproach. Yet I would hope we would not make someone feel guilty, at least initially, about something that springs up spontaneously. You can't do very much about that feeling, but you can counter it. Like physical illness, the Dalai Lama insisted, preventive measures are the best way. Yes, if some disease has already developed, then there's no other choice but to take medicine. So similarly, once a person develops a strong negative emotion, like anger or jealousy, it is very difficult to counter it at that moment. So the best thing is to cultivate your mind through practice so that you can learn to prevent it from arising in the first place. For example, the major source of anger is frustration and dissatisfaction. At the moment when an emotion like anger is full-blown, even if we try to take our experience and our knowledge and use it to reduce it, we will find it is very difficult to stop. At that point, it is like a flood. During monsoon season, it is too late to stop the flooding. We need to start early in the spring and investigate what is causing the flooding and try to build flood walls to prevent disaster. Similarly, for our mental health also, the earlier we start practicing preventive measures, the easier and more effective they are. When we are already sick, it is hard to remember our doctor's advice. I think no doctor would say, if you have more anger, you will be healthier. Does your doctor say that? No, the Archbishop agreed. Well, we come now to the end of our program, and we will finish this chapter and go on to others in the coming weeks. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.